What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Murder Unscripted, the podcast that aims to immerse you in the true crime genre like never before. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
So now you're just saying we aim to do it. Does that mean we don't definitely do it, like you generally say?
We do it, but you can't be. You can't claim that, you know?
You did claim it, and I asked you if you could claim it. You said, sure, everybody does it.
Okay, well, we aim and we feel like we are the most immersive true crime podcast out there.
Fair.
And All right. We had teased at the end of last week that we had an incredibly special guest this week. And this woman has interviewed on countless TV shows, including The Today Show, The View, Larry King Live, just to name a few. And she's a huge player on the anti-domestic violence circuit. She's written two books, including Finding Peace Amid the Chaos, My Escape from Depression and Suicide, as well as The Seven Characteristics of Abuse, Where It Starts and Where It Can End. But most importantly, and I feel like all of this gets lost, she's a human being who was forced to grieve the death of her sister, Nicole Brown Simpson, amid absolute chaos. It was a media frenzy, which had some devastating effects on her and her family. But over the years, she's managed to turn these struggles into an empowering message about how to cope with trauma and grief. And her mission now is to provide folks with the tools they need to overcome adversity and change their lives for the better. So ladies and gentlemen, Murder Unscripted is proud to welcome for a conversation, Tanya Brown.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm not sure how many episodes you've seen, but what we do is we tell hour-long stories, crime stories, but we offer some behind-the-scenes stuff, and then we bring on guests. And while it is a crime show, we definitely want to focus on Nicole today, because I feel like every time there's a production about her case, the same facts and stories crop up and over and over and over again, and they kind of get lost behind the salacious nature of this case. So obviously, we need to talk a bit about what happened, but we really want to talk about Nicole. And I think right off the bat, one of the most interesting things about her is that people forget that she wasn't even born in America. She was born in Germany.
She was born in Germany. Like, German is like her first language. So her and Denise was born in Germany. So Denise and Dominique are very close to our cousins in Germany. And they can chat in German. And I'm like, how do you do? You got to keep in mind, I'm 12 years younger than Denise, right? I'm 10 years younger than Nicole. I'm 5 years younger than Dominique. But everybody kind of left the house, you know, when I was seven, you know, right? Seven or nine. Denise left the house, I think, when I was, you know, nine and or seven. And then Nicole left the house when I was nine. And then Dominique and I, we kind of went through junior high and high school together. So Dominique is kind of like my relationship that Denise and Nicole had.
Gotcha.
Because we're closer in age. So it really baffles me when I hear my sister speak in German. I'm like, what?
You're like, what is this tongue you're speaking in?
I took German classes and I got C minuses and Frauer knows. Like, why? Like, You're getting C minuses. You're German.
How are you doing this?
But yeah, I mean, these are things that people don't know about my sister. Mm-hmm. And thank you for raising that. You know, people,
of course,
I just don't want people to recognize her as a battered woman and a domestic violence victim or just anybody else. Like, I want to know who the Nicole was, like the boy crazy stuff. Like, when we were cleaning out our garage, there was a surfboard and it was an OP.
Yeah.
Remember?
What was that? Ocean Pacific.
So it was an OP surfboard that was hanging over. We lived on the beach. So there were boogie boards and surfboards. So when we were moving out of Monarch, I was like, where's this OP surfboard? And it was Nicole's. And I think Denise in the docuseries shared something about a surfing experience with Nick, and somebody, but like Denise buckled, but Nicole was able to do it, and Nicole kept going, and Denise was kind of like, I'm going to take a step back. You know, those are the stories that I want to hear about my sister. And I felt like maybe the Lifetime docuseries didn't do that for me.
Yeah, I want to get into that. So I want to literally start at the beginning. So you're the baby sister. So you obviously had a different perspective on everything. But what was it like growing up in a house with four girls? It sounds chaotic.
Ask my dad if he was still alive. You know what? We all got along. I think we fight more now as adults than we did when we were kids. And when I say fight, it's like, I'm not saying fighting or anything like that. It's just as you grow older, you become different, you grow, you evolve. But I will always be that 8-year-old girl. I will always be the baby sister.
That's awesome.
That, I'm just like, no, it's not.
Oh, it's not? I thought that was a good thing. I thought the babies get everything.
Like, no, I'm a 55-year-old woman that,
yeah.
Right? Where I'm just like,
adult. Yeah.
I'm an adult, but when everybody sees you as a kid, it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, I get that.
But growing up, man, we had great days. I grew up in a really, all of us, not just me, we grew up in a really, an amazing home. Mom and dad had respect for each other, adoration for one another. If you look at the photos of my dad and my mom together, it's like dad, like the old photos, I'm not talking about media photos or anything like that, but family photos. Dad was always like protecting my mom, but my mom was a feisty German. They just understood each other. I can't explain it. It was such a healthy relationship to the point where my mom said to me one time, she goes, I think what daddy and I have has like worked against you. Just beautiful human beings, respected each other, respected others. Just that's how we were raised.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, it's a great problem to have.
I very much admire your parents' strength. I was reading your book and like your dad, they've both been through it, but like your dad had experienced more loss than so many people. And just the way you talked about them, and it seems like your mom was like the backbone of the family and kept everybody in order.
For sure. Absolutely. So daddy was a bomber pilot in World War II. So I think like 12 or 13 fleet, like they went out, but only 3 came back. And my dad was one of them. Man. And so when my dad started to exhibit signs of Alzheimer's, it was like he started sharing notes, and it's kind of like, okay, I got to take this down, because World War II, like that generation, they didn't talk about what they went through.
Right.
And so I learned a lot about my dad when he was declining, and what an amazing soul, very stoic. So when you see, over like when you watch the verdict being read, how everybody was being so stoic. Well, one, we were being coached on how to respond and react to the verdict, but you can just see, just remain calm. But I remember my mom saying this one day, she, sometimes you got to have like a little like flip out, right? My mom was like, can you just like take the change out of your pocket instead of out of, like have that be the first thing that you do before you go to bed. Can you empty out your right pocket? Like my mom was kind of just like ruffle things a little bit, just up a little bit. But my dad was very military. So his side of the sink was very organized. My mom and his mom was like messy and just things everywhere, right? So, but that's what made them beautiful. My parents just worked. So beautiful what they had.
Wow. Well, if you describe for me when in this household that seemed so perfect, I'm sure there were little 10 years is a big difference between you and Nicole, but I'm sure you guys had your own special little relationship. So could you tell me just about some of the, as children or younger, I should say, how you guys got along? Describe her personality.
You know, this is the hard part about doing interviews like this. I was just getting to know Nicole. I was just getting to know Denise, you know, because they left the house when I was 7 and 9. So it's really hard for me to answer that. But from what I remember a lot of Nicole, sadly, through pictures, like family albums, not lived out. Like my lived out experiences with Nicole are kind of like the Thanksgivings and Christmases and our holidays, things like that. But growing up, you know, when I was a kid, I don't remember her.
It's interesting. I've run into people like that when we do these crime shows, because we'll sometimes interview children who were in the room. They were babies, you know, so they were there and like part of the story, but they don't remember it. So we'll do an interview with them and they talk about their experience growing up with just stories of my mom or my sibling or my this. So it's really, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a disconnect, but not like in the therapy world, it's not a dissociation, right? Where it's not like I'm so traumatized to where, you know, I'm disconnecting and disassociating myself with that. It's like, I honestly like have a disconnect with Nicole because I was so much younger. I have a disconnect with Denise still today at 55, you know, because right. Like we're grown, women, right? We've grown, but you left the house when I was so young. And it's like, I really don't even know you, you know, and the only, you know, I have a great relationship with her. My God, I'll, you know, stand in front of a train and a bullet for my sister. Absolutely. But we don't know each other we could grow together now as adults. You know, I think like dad being sick and mom being sick and then Aaron, my nephew dying. And it was just a lot. So, you know, maybe perhaps, you know, in months and years to come, it's okay. At the end of the day, I will defend my sister to both of them to the nine.
As you should. Good for you.
Absolutely.
Well, then let me ask you. So as you guys grew up and then kind of reconnected, talk to me about Nicole's personality. When she kind of blossomed into her own woman and her own personality and the Nicole that you saw and knew, who was she?
Oh my God. Okay. So I'm going to share a story about my 12th birthday. And I think you and I had spoke about this. This is the Nicole that I knew. So it was my 12th birthday and Nick and OJ had a condo in San Francisco and she had this, like, I think it was like a 924 Porsche.
Porsche,
right? And it had like white and black checkered seats. And she was like, you know what? Just pack a bag and we're going to take a little road trip up the coast of California from, you know, Laguna Beach. And we're going to go all the way to San Francisco. And I'm like, yay, I'm 12. I'm like, oh my God, this is so exciting.
Best day of your life.
Okay. First of all, I didn't even know like football. So football is going to be the caveat, like at the end of this story. But I was like, yay. Oh my God. Road trip with my big sis. This is going to be so much fun. So we hit, I don't know if we did Disneyland. I think I said that when you and I initially talked, but I don't think so. But we definitely did Knott's Berry Farm. How do I know that? For sure. Because Nick had, Nicole was very sophisticated and very sexy. Like she could wear yoga pants and look like she could roll out of bed and look like hot. Like I hated her. Okay.
She's gorgeous.
Everything in hindsight, I'm like, oh my God, I wish I looked like you. So here we are. We go to Knott's Berry Farm in California, and there's this ride. I don't think they have it anymore, but it was like the parachute goes up, right? And then it like, it drops you, but it, mm-hmm. it's like a parachute. Okay. Okay. So Nick had tight jeans on and a loose white shirt. And as we came down, the shirt went up.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I just remember, like, pulling your shirt down.
You're like, no.
Yeah, we shared the canopy or whatever you, the carriage with.
Yeah. Other
people. I'm like, oh, my God, Nick.
That is awesome.
You know, but you don't think about things like that. So, anyway, and then we went on the corkscrew. And I was so scared to go on this roller coaster. You guys, I'm sharing this. I'm 12 years old.
Right. You're 12.
Yeah.
And I was so scared to go on the corkscrew. And I'm like, Nick, I can't do it. I can't do it. Did it. Well, you know, later on, I became like a roller coaster junkie, probably.
Yeah.
But the Boy Scouts came. She was like, can you talk to my sister? Like, she really wants to go on this, on the corkscrew at Knott's Berry Farm in California. And the Boy Scouts came and talked me into it. And I was like, okay, great. So we went on the corkscrew. Then I know this sounds really, really silly to a lot of people. But to me, if there's any memory of Nicole, it's this experience. And, my 12th birthday. So went on the roller coaster, had a great time, got over my fear, wanted to start a roller coaster club when I was in high school, probably because of that. And then we went up the coast and we went to the Hearst Castle. And I just remember just like, I had never like seen this part of our state before. I was like, oh my God, this is so beautiful, like, you know. And we went up the coast to Big Sur, and you know, I mean, and that's kind of a scary drive if you've ever done it.
I haven't done it. I've seen it though. It looks terrifying.
You look over, yeah. Like, yeah. don't sneeze. and then we got to San Francisco and we got to her condo, and she said, she goes, there's a birthday present for you on the bed. And I go, okay, like, yay, I'm 12 years old. I'm sharing this at 55. I'm 12 years old. And I remember seeing this IZOD box. IZOD, remember the cardigan?
With the little alligator, yep.
Right? The alligator, yep. The red, the green, or whatever it is. And and I opened it up, and it was this cardigan with two bobby pins that were crammed. Yeah. Like, it was like two crayon, like, bobby pins. And I was like, oh my God, this is so fun. And so then the next day, OJ was playing in Candlestick Park. And that was my first football game, pro football
no kidding.
Game ever. My sisters, you know, they were old enough to go to Buffalo when he played for Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a kid. So they saw all the good moves, right?
Yeah, right.
Stuck with 49ers. Whatever. But I love the 49ers because of just the nostalgia.
Well, yeah, that means something special to you. I mean, the fact that when we were talking about some of your favorite memories of Nicole on the phone, and that one like came right to you, it must be something that you will cherish for the rest of your life.
Forever. I'll forever remember it. And here we are. We're not shortly, like, I don't know where we were, but I wasn't too far from where all the football players were, but I just, OJ had turned around and I was like, hi, Uncle OJ. Like, I didn't see what my sisters saw in him. No. I didn't even see a football player. Like, I didn't know football. I was just like, yay, hi, you know,
go sports.
Yeah, I'm 12 and, right. And we grew up in a house full of girls. We didn't watch football.
Right.
I'm a football fan until I really went to UC San Diego and became a Charger fan, you know? Wow. So mm-hmm. I didn't know football at all. It was just like, oh my God, yay, hi. It was like, And it was just being so there. Cold.
Yeah.
Cold. It was November. And I remember they have their big heavy coats. And, but that I will always remember that story. Just that experience that
I love
the little sister with the big sister driving up the coast.
What a cool big sister. I was looking at pictures of all of you. It's like you had the coolest big sister ever.
Ever. But Denise was cool too. And she still is, you know, we're just a little bit different now. But when Denise was living in New York and coming back home to visit, you know, me being the little, you know, only child of four girls, the little brat of the family, because I was the brat. I will admit, I was the brat. I was the spoiled little princess. Whatever. Just like my dad was probably tired. Like,
I would get this.
Yeah.
Just so she shuts up, right? But Denise would come home from New York, and I was like, okay, Denise, we need to go to Hello Kitty in Laguna, and you need to get me some stickers. And so that was my, you know, my connection with Denise. Like, we need to go to Hello Kitty. There was a Hello Kitty store in Laguna. And so that's where we went. So all these little different stories. Yeah.
So I have a question. It's well documented that, like, being a mom was absolutely just the highlight of Nicole's life. Do you feel like that's a fair statement?
Absolutely. You know, again, everything in hindsight. When my sisters all started having kids, I was 13.
Yeah, you were a kid.
I was a kid. And I was like the only child, right? Of four. Okay.
Wow.
Like, read between the lines on that one. So when all these little grommets started coming in, I'm like, yeah, it was something. It was something. It was an adjustment that I never adjusted to.
Yeah.
And we still laugh about it. We do. Like, everybody goes, oh, you were the fun aunt. And I'm like, no, actually, no. I'm kind of like, I was kind of the evil aunt. Like, get out of my way. You're on my turf. You're invading my space.
I wasn't
the most pleasant aunt. I will say it.
It's funny though how kids view the world. So I'm a stepdad now, and it's tough not to parent my stepson, because, like, that's the role I'm in now, and I feel like I need to just be an authority figure sometimes. But, like, so I'll get on him about what he's eating, what his homework, this and that. But then out of nowhere, I'm probably thinking he thinks I'm such a jerk because I'm always on him for something. But at the same time, he just the other day said, you're so much fun. Would you chaperone this field trip? So I think kids,
wow,
as long as you still do the fun things, you can still be a little.
Absolutely. A little tough. Good for you. So yeah. I was really young, right? So mm-hmm. So this is what I did. Okay. So I'm readjusting I put the kids in a room watching Chucky.
Well, it's a movie about a doll. It's totally fine.
I thought it was funny, but honestly, it still comes up.
So I have no doubt.
Like, traumatized, because that's who I am. That's why I don't want to work with children. I like them. I love them. I'm just not.
I can't be trusted.
I'm not good with them. I'm not going to hurt them. Neither. Yeah, no, like Sydney just goes, she lives in St. Pete's, and she's like, yeah, she goes, don't you remember when you and Rico, like my ex-boyfriend, put us in a room with all of us, like all my nieces and nephews, all seven of them, because Krista wasn't born yet. And it was like all seven of them. And yeah, and we put on Chucky.
You are the fun aunt.
They're 30 years old, 30 plus years old.
They remember that. They'll
remember that. I'm like, oh my God, that's my legacy.
Oh my.
That's something I would do.
Yeah. Oh man, Tanya. Well, I'll tell you what, when you did get older and you started hanging out with Nicole then and started doing like adult things and bonding, there was a story that stuck out to me too about you guys going to the Ivy in Beverly Hills, and Damon Wayans was involved. So can you tell us that story?
And thank you for remembering.
Of course.
I, It's I think it was Dominique's birthday, and we were at the Ivy in Beverly Hills, like you said, and Nick was kind of like dressed in costume Chanel jewelry, costume stuff. But the costume stuff from Chanel is like money, right?
Yeah.
It was just Nicole, Denise, Dominique, my mom, and I. It was just the girls. No boys allowed, no dads, no husbands, no nothing, no boyfriends, nothing. It was just the girls. And we were having a great time. And when I say we were having a great time, we were having a great time. And in walks Damon Wayans with his younger brother. And I'm sorry,
Marlon, maybe?
Marlon. And they walked in. And it was during the Fly Girl season, right? And
Melissa is too young to even know.
Living Color.
Melissa doesn't know what that is.
Oh, I know what Living Color is.
So Nicole got up, and I would stand up, but I have, you know, pink polka dotted pajamas.
So do I. Me, same.
She got up, and she goes, Damon! And the Ivy is small. And Nick stands up, and she goes, hey! I want to be a Fly Girl.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like,
everyone starts looking.
I was like, oh, good for you. But that was Nicole. Nicole had fun. Nicole was fun. So when the bill came, you know how they give you the little tray, right? She took off all her jewelry and said, here, I think this will pay for it.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, obviously, she ended up paying, right?
Yeah, right.
It was like, she was silly. She was quirky. She was fun. And so then we all got back home. And then that night, we went to the Roxbury. And, I mean, back in the day, right? The Roxbury was the happening place. The Night of Roxbury was a movie, I guess.
Yep.
On, right, this thing, right?
Yeah.
We saw Heavy D.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, Nick kind of dressed, you know, kind of like a Peg Bundy with her, like her leggings with like a Hanes t-shirt, right?
I love it.
She just had this confidence, this aura, this sexiness about her that, like, she was fearless. She was totally fearless. And so there was like this interception, like within a stairwell. And she goes, so Heavy D was there. And she goes, wow, you really are heavy.
That is awesome. It sounds like she was just so hurt. Like she was a real person, down to earth.
Down to earth. You know, just down to earth.
Yeah, and you hit it so perfectly because I feel like every picture I've seen of Nicole, and she could be wearing workout clothes in one. I mean, there's so many pictures out there. Dressed up, dressed down, dressed casual. And she was always just naturally beautiful.
Very natural. I mean, she honestly can roll out of bed. My favorite picture of her is when she's kind of like sitting like this. And she's in a towel because the kids wanted to go to the swimming pool. We were in Hawaii and she literally like rolled out of bed and she was like this because I was babysitting the kids at the time. So I was kind of like the babysitter or nanny at times only because she knew I, you know, starving student, you know, right? Where it's kind of like, hey, Tanya, I could use a babysitter here, you know, all of that. So, you know, with that, that's how I, you know, got to know some different parts of her. And, but I'll just, yeah, she kind of just like, Nick just rolled out of bed and was like, and just looked beautiful. I hate her.
Talk to me about her meeting OJ. So she was head over heels.
Head over heels. From what I so you got to remember, like what I share with you is what I hear, right?
Of course.
Because I don't remember because I was seven. The only thing that I remember the first time meeting OJ, I was like, he came to the house and I said, I didn't even care. I go, I want a Barbie house. It was the first thing out of my head. I was like, I want a Barbie house. I was just a brat. I was a brat. And I honestly, like, yeah, I heard that title. I go, I want a Barbie house. Well, okay. Well, can I get to know your family a little bit? And then eventually Nick and OJ took me down to Laguna and got me a Barbie house. I didn't ask you if you got it. I want a Barbie house.
Well, yeah, duh. I mean, where are they going to stay? I mean,
right.
Later, they bought you a bike too, right? The dollhouse and the bike.
Yeah. And it was kind of I think I was probably like 11 or 12. And ironically, so we grew up in Monarch Bay. It was just a very tight community. And for some reason, all of us, all the kids, the Mobilias, the Froms, the Montos, you can mention their names, it doesn't matter. We all got bicycles that year on Christmas. I don't know if there was communication within the neighborhood because there was only a core group of kids. I don't know, but I remember that Christmas we were all cruising around on our bikes.
That's so cool. And now that you mention it, it would be neat to like coordinate something like that. Have all the kids that are the same age all get something like that where they can do it together. That's very interesting.
I hold Monarch Bay very, very near and dear to my heart because that's where I grew up. Denise and Nicole grew up in Garden Grove and maybe even Dominique too, you know, but I grew up in Monarch Bay. I moved there when I was 4. I don't know anything different. And the only way I remember, you know, Garden Grove is through pictures. And the only way that I really remember childhood memories with Nicole is through pictures because she left when I was 9 years old.
Well, and as far as OJ goes, I mean, I think it's fair to say that you didn't see the side of him that your sister saw, at least until later.
I can't go back to when I was a kid.
Of course.
To remember my initial reaction. I mean, I'm 55 and I was 7 when I met him, but I do remember where he was sitting at our kitchen table. He was sitting. So we had a kitchen table that kind of, it wasn't separated. It was kind of like an island that kind of extended, and he was sitting there and I was standing here. I remember that I do remember. And then I said, where's my Barbie house?
I love that.
But my initial reaction, you know, everybody was like, oh, were you enamored because he was a football player? And I'm like, no, we're like beach people. Like,
sure.
Yeah.
We're playing. We're hanging out. We're doing the sun, right? We're doing beach things. Like, we're girls. And like earlier, like, I didn't become a football fan until I really moved to San Diego. So I didn't know who he was. I didn't know the concept of the NFL. I didn't know the concept or the science or the relationship of AFC, NFC, and all that. Mm-hmm. I didn't know all of that, you know? So my initial impression was, here's a man who's dating my sister, and here they are.
And that's it. Well, as you got older, the story that we talked about on the phone, because you were the baby, you were shielded from a lot of things, I think, that were going on. But then there was a moment where it was kind of the first time that you saw fear.
So the first time I saw fear, I was at UCLA visiting my friend Bobby, and we just wanted to go into Westwood, have, you know, a great time. I don't even know where we went or what we did. But the next morning, my mom called and she goes, Tanya, I need you to go to Rockingham to help Nicole move. She goes, I can't be there. She goes, I just can't see this. For some reason, my mom was protecting herself. I can't speak what she knew or what she didn't know. I don't know. All I can share with you is she goes, I can't do this. I'm not strong enough. And I was like, okay. But at the same time, I was like, I'm a young 20-year-old. Mm-hmm. All I want to do is go out in Westwood and hang out with my college friend, right? Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I cut that, you know, weekend short, and I went to Rockingham. And going in, knowing that Nick and OJ are divorcing, but I'm just thinking, okay, what divorce is pleasant?
Right.
They're never pleasant. None. They're never amicable. If they're amicable, like, good for you, you know? But I remember going in and I said, okay, Mom, like, I get it. I'll go. Sorry, Bobby. Catch you next weekend. And I walked into Rockingham and I said, Nick? And she goes, yeah, I'm upstairs. And I said, okay. So I walked up the staircase that everybody has seen. I go into the master suite and she goes, shut the door, lock the door, and get Daddy on the phone. And I'm like, okay. Now keep in mind, I knew nothing about Nicole's abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing about it. And so I'm like, okay. So I get upstairs, I shut the door, I lock the door, I get Daddy on the phone. And I said, Daddy, Nick just wants me to have you on the phone. I go, I don't know what's happening. She goes, Tanya, he has guns in the closet and he's not afraid to use them.
Wow.
Now you don't know what you like. We don't know guns. We don't know violence. I'm like, nobody would like now
actually, right.
Like actually kill you? Like,
right.
Yeah.
So I was like, hey, Daddy, like Nick just casually, I'm 20 years old.
Wow.
You know, keep in mind, like what I want your listeners to really grasp is that 30 years ago, we didn't talk about this stuff. We didn't know what we know now. So please don't judge me on this. Please do not judge my family on this. Like, you just don't think that somebody who you have known since you were 7 years old was capable of committing, like, just being nasty, because we're not even mm-hmm. there. Just being nasty and making everything difficult. And so I was like, Daddy, I don't know. She just wants me to stay on the phone with you. And she goes, don't say anything. Just keep them on the phone. And I said, okay. And I remember, so when I'm looking at, so I'm sitting, if I'm like looking at the foot of the bed to like their headboard, I'm on OJ's side because that's where the phone was. Okay. And I'm kneeling down. I'm kneeling down to kind of keep everything quiet. And I'm like, to me, I'm like, God dang, this is like, this is bad. Like, this is a divorce that has gone bad, but not violent. Just like, right? You don't think that somebody is actually going to kill you.
Because it's so outlandish. You don't want to go there in your mind. You don't think that extreme.
That doesn't happen to us. Like, that doesn't happen to, it doesn't happen to, it doesn't happen to me. It doesn't happen to my sister. It doesn't happen to my family. Like, we just, like, all I was there, I was just taking direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were done with the master suite, packing everything up. And then we went to Sydney's room. And Sydney's room, if you look at Rockingham, Sydney's room overlooked the circular driveway. And so Nicole was emptying out her chest, but was facing the door. My back was facing the bedroom door. And all of a sudden, everything in hindsight, she like looked up and it was something very stark, very, that was the first time I saw fear in a court. That was the very first time I was like, okay. And so I turned around and I was like, oh, hey, OJ, thinking nothing of it because I didn't know what was going on. I was like, hey, OJ, I'm just thinking this is just a divorce that has gone bad. And I'm here to support my sister, make the move of whatever she feels, you know, necessary. I'm here for Nicole. And so we finished up in Sydney's room. Then we went downstairs, and in her dining area, all the crystal and the fine china and whatever, I don't even remember, but I remember there being like a lot of vases and everything being on the dining room table. And I was like, I go, Nick, I go, what is all of this? And she goes, I don't know. He wanted me to put everything out on the dining room table and da da da. I go, can't you just do one for me, one for you, one for me, one
yeah,
for
right.
Right? Make it easy. Why does everything need to be so difficult? Again, like, you don't know domestic violence until you're in it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. It's that innocent perspective. Like, it should be. Yeah.
Right? It's like, it's innocent. It's like, why are you making everything so difficult? And she, and those were her words. Like, why, like I asked her, why is he being so difficult? Why is he making everything so difficult? She goes, I don't know. It's just who he is. Not one time did she ever say he's threatening me, he's hurting me, he's beating me, he's doing this to me. Nothing.
How long was this before the incident?
Okay, so I was helping her move out of Rockingham into Gretna Green. So I don't remember being at Gretna Green. So somebody probably intercepted somewhere in between that move. I don't remember. All I remember is being there at Gretna Green or at Rockingham. I don't remember her moving into Gretna Green, like with all of her stuff in her box. I think that's when my mom showed up, is like, she just couldn't, she couldn't go to the house.
Yeah.
Like, just couldn't. And so I think, because I don't remember moving Nicole into Gretna Green, and God, I hated that house. Just everything, the acoustics were bad. Just, and you know, and like I told you earlier, right? Like she would hire me to kind of like be a little babysitter. So yeah, when I put the kids to sleep, there was like an indoor patio, like an indoor, not a patio, not a courtyard. It was inside like an indoor balcony. So the acoustics just like, I'm like, can you keep your voices down? I just put the kids to sleep. I don't like kids. I'm just here for the paycheck.
Just here to get, but yep.
Right.
Yeah. Watch Chucky. Yeah. Jeez. Go,
I'm like,
go
away. Whatever. I love Sydney. I love Justin, but just like, just
leave me alone.
I hated that house on so many levels. Yeah.
Well, Gretna Green was where, that was the first 911 call that I heard where Nicole actually called that things were going on. So was there anything in that time period where your eyes started to open to what was going on?
So so Bobby, my friend from UCLA, I was like, so Nick wanted me, there was a moment where she needed to take the kids somewhere, not just Sydney and Justin, but kids, like a group of kids. So I guess OJ and her had like a minivan, but the minivan was at Rockingham. And she was like, Tanya, I need you to go to Rockingham and get the minivan. So I was like, okay. So Bobby was with me and I'm like, okay, not a problem. Like, not knowing, keep in mind, mm-hmm. Nicole never shared anything with me. I never experienced any violence. I never witnessed any control or anything, nothing at all. So here I am, Bobby and I, we go to Rockingham and to get, you know, to get the car. But I remember like we were sitting in the kitchen and OJ and I and Bobby were all kind of like, hey, how are you? Like, you know, like I've known you since I was 7 years old.
Right.
Had Nicole told me what she was going through and what he had done to her, I never would have sat down in his couch.
Of course.
Give me the keys and I'm out. That's it. But Nick never shared with me the pain that he inflicted on her. Like, never. So here I am, I'm sitting in their kitchen and catching up, like, hey, how's life? Is this hard? Are you good? Like, what's going on? Like, small talk. I don't even remember what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And then grabbed the keys, went back to Green, and Nick got mad at me. She got really mad at me. She was like, all I asked you was to go and pick up the car.
Wow.
I had no idea. Everything in hindsight. And it was New Year's Eve, 1992. We were at Spago's in Beverly Hills. And Nick goes, we're at like a big table. And all I remember, like Walter Matthau. Like there were all wow. these like, super celebrities, but there was Walter Matthau. And I loved grumpy old men and women, right? So I'm like, oh my God, there's... Like, oh my God. So I was so enamored by Walter Matthau. He goes, I need to go to the bathroom. Come with me. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's what girls do, right? We go to the bathroom mm-hmm. together. And she sat down in a little chair in the corner before the restroom. And she just goes, I'm asking for a divorce tonight. Wow. And I was like, the first thing out of my mouth, not knowing her history, not knowing anything, not even having my bachelor degree, not even having my graduate degree, knowing nothing, just me being a little sister from Laguna Beach. And I asked her, I said, do you love your kids? And she goes, more than I love my own life. Very, very seriously. I remember nonverbals. I remember everything as if it was yesterday. And I said, then Nick, I go, you're doing the right thing. I said, kids don't understand what mom and dad are going through, but they will feel it.
They will.
Them and mom and dad aren't happy or doing well. I said, so yeah, you're doing the right thing. Then she said this, don't tell Dita, my mom. And I was like, no, I'm the little sister who doesn't know anything about children, who's not a mom. I'm 20 years old. Of course, I'm going to tell my mom.
Right.
Right.
And so that's when my mom was like, I can't go to Rockingham. She's like, this was just too hard for me, mm-hmm. I think.
And these people that stay together for the kids, it never ends well. I mean,
it doesn't end well. What you're doing, especially like in Nick's like situation, you're raising an abuser, you're raising a victim. And, you know, but Nicole, like, Sydney is anything but a victim. Whew, that girl is tough as ice. Like she's tough. Like she's good. You know, yeah. And so is Justin. You know, everybody's doing well. But Nicole's life wasn't all bad. You know, everybody like 24/7, she lived a battered woman's life. No, she didn't. She didn't. She had good times, many good times in between. Why do you think she stayed?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The victims of domestic violence, they don't stay because somebody is violent. They stay because, oh my God, like, where are you? Where's this person that I married? Mm-hmm. Where's this person that I got to know? Where are you?
And I could be making this up. This could not be true at all. But did she say the night you all went out for dinner, kind of right before this happened?
His soulmate.
Yeah, that he's my soulmate.
Yep. I didn't go to the recital because I was like, I don't want to go to another soccer practice or dance recital. Like,
yeah.
I'm young. It's like, no, I would rather like sit on the TV and watch Shamu.
Yeah.
Right. Like I'm just, mm-hmm. And that's what I did. There was like a special on Shamu in San Diego. And I mean, that's what I did. I was like, nothing like, I'm just not that person. And, but I remember sitting there on the couch. God, it was really like weird. So here I am, I'm sitting and my mom walks by very slowly and very stoically, like right by me. And I was like, hey, Dita, like, hi, mama. Like, what's going on? She went straight to her bedroom. It was really, really strange. And then Minnie and Denise and my dad came in and I go, what's wrong with mom? Like, what's happening? Like, that was really weird. and she was so focused on her glasses on the drive home. We need to turn around and get my glasses. We need to turn around and get my glasses. I guess she was like very quiet, but it was like she was also fixated on the glasses. Like she didn't know where her glasses were. And I just remember we didn't have the cell phone, but you have like the remote phone. And I remember her standing between the entry of her bedroom to the living room, having a conversation with Nicole, saying, "No, Nick," I don't know what Nick was saying on the other side, but she says, "No, Nick, don't worry. No, honey, don't worry about it. Just pick them up on your run tomorrow." Well, what we later found out is that Nicole was telling my mom that, you know, Ron was on his way down to Marina Del Rey to meet some friends. I'll drop the glasses off. Wow. So when my mom's glasses were on her lap, so when she got out of the car, they fell out.
Oh,
that's how that happened. Mm. And that was a really hard day for my mom, because we all went down to the beach that day, because like where we were, there was an empty parking lot across the street. So all the media, we lived behind a gate, but on the other side, on the like the south east corner of the intersection, all the media trucks were there honing in all of our conversations. And so we would have to go to the beach to share, you know, what we need to talk about, because they were honing in on everything. And my mom turned to us and said, "Girls, will you ever forgive me for leaving the glasses?"
Oh.
And I remember me saying, "You didn't leave your glasses, you dropped your glasses."
Hindsight is always 20/20. And I feel like when these things happen, people find any little thing that happened that day that could have happened to anyone at any time and latch on to that as like, "If only I didn't," or "If only."
And that is, like, working with my clients, because I do grief counseling, not counseling, but grief coaching. And I'm like, you can say the shoulda, coulda, would've all day long. And, you know, but if you do that, it's going to beat you. It's going to put you further down into the grave than where your loved one is, if you do that, because you're still on this side of the grass. And that is no way to live. But, you know, I mean, I'm having this conversation with you 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's been a lot of therapy. There's been a couple of suicide attempts on my end, because I had so much unresolved grief and anger and things that I didn't know. Like, I wasn't even mad that OJ killed her. I was mad at my sister for not telling me. Wow. That's where my grief was.
Interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm. That's where my grief was. I was like, man, why didn't you tell me? You had the perfect chance, the perfect opportunity a couple of times to share this with me, and you never did. So I had a lot of anger towards Nicole. And then it kind of, you know, I healed from that. And then, of course, then you get mad at him because he's the one who committed the crimes. But initially, I was really mad at Nicole. And I attempted a suicide 10 years after, because I had so much unresolved grief, so many unresolved, like, unanswered questions, that I never even knew I had. So that's why I'm an advocate, like, face your fear, face your stress, face your trauma, walk through it, not around it. Don't wait. Don't succumb to it. Like, really, like, walk through your pain. And it is hard. It is ugly. It's scary. And it can be very lonely and isolating. But you're not alone. I mean, I went through it, but I had a trigger that happened, and that was the cancellation of my wedding 4 days before. Had that not happened, I probably would not be the woman who I am today.
Wow.
And I think Michael and I were dear friends. It just didn't work. You know, he got cold feet and that's okay. But I said to him when I was in the psych unit, I said, whatever you do, do not cancel my insurance because I worked with him. And I'm like, please just don't cancel my insurance. I need this. Because I knew there was something else going on. There was something deeper. It was it wasn't like, oh my God, boo-hoo, you canceled my wedding and all. No, it was something deeper and darker and scarier than I had ever imagined. And without him, honestly, I would not be here today. And I let him know because he does, he feels bad as he should, you know, as he should feel bad. But at the same time, that man saved my life.
Wow. You wrote something in your book. You wrote, they say success is the best revenge, and I'm ready to get revenge on depression.
Yes.
And you've been very open with your mental health. So I feel like I'm just going to go ahead and be open with mine that I struggle with mental health as well. But it took me a second for that quote to like process in my brain, because usually when people say that, they're saying it like they want to succeed to get revenge on another person. But to succeed and to be happy and get revenge on your depression, I had never, ever thought about it that way. And I feel like that's such a powerful quote.
It shouldn't own you.
Yeah.
You know, I battle with depression still to this day, battle with anxiety still to this day. But it doesn't own me. I own it. So on those hard, right? Like on those hard day, but it takes work. Mm-hmm. I don't roll out of bed all cheery peaches and cream every day. Are you kidding me? Like, you know, and I'm not one to give gratitude right out of, you know, everybody's like, hey, before you get out of bed, like give gratitude. It is a great coping skill and it worked for me at that time. But now today I kind of listened to Mel Robbins, 5-4-3-2-1. The 5-second rule.
Do you know? I'm not familiar. No.
So, it makes sense. It's so listen to, you know, one of her podcasts, and it was kind of like she was watching a liftoff. She was in huge depression, huge despair. And, you know, she was like, you know, Houston goes 5-4-3-2-1 launch, right? So when you're laying in bed, instead of sitting, you know, hitting the snooze button, which I did today, I'm a work in progress, you guys. So I'm always trying to find things that will work for me in my chapter of where I am right now.
Because I get that.
Where I am today is not where I was last week or last month.
Right. But that's all you can hope to do is just keep growing every day. You know.
So she goes 5-4-3-2-1. Get out of bed, because if you go 1-2-3-4-5, you can go 6-7-8-9-10, 11-12, interesting, 14-15. So it's like when you get to launch time, it's like you're launching, and that has really helped me over the past couple of weeks. Like get out of bed,
like even just do it.
Dress up, and it's hard, especially with people who battle with depression. It's hard. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying this is easy. I'm not. My medications are being adjusted because my hormones now at 55 are changing. Oh, so everything, I like
a real roller coaster.
I have a fan and I don't leave home without it. It's like my American Express card. But it's you got to be honest with depression. It's but that's the thing. It doesn't own me. I own it. But I will tell you this, I will sit in my depression for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. I will sit in it. And I don't avoid it. I don't deny it because it's real.
Yeah.
It's real. It is. So it's not like I'm going to go, okay, I'm so depressed, I'm going to keep working, or I'm going to read, or I'm going to stay so busy that I don't feel. That is the biggest, that's the biggest mistake anybody can do.
Well, and I feel like the people who are so quick to be like, just get over it. The people that have never gone through it, they feel like it's just, just knock it off. Just be happy. And it's not easy when you're going through it.
It's not easy. It is, like I said in my book, it is like a medieval, like ball and chain to the ankle of your leg.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't escape from it. And it's, you know, and then talking about that, that's the physical part. The emotional part is imagine like your skin being removed and the wind hitting your nerves. And that's painful. And that's depression. Depression is real, but that's my advocacy. Like sit in it, feel it, know it, be aware of it, but also reach out because you are not alone. I've got my five people. So I always encourage people like have your five top five, because if one's not available, two, three, four are not available, but maybe five will be. And if none are available, call 988. I've called 988 probably about three or four times since its inception.
Wow. But good for you for having the courage to say, I need help, to just reach out.
Got to reach out because there's like, I don't know where I read it. I don't remember what study, but it's like, if you could hold on for 20 minutes from the inception of that suicidal ideation to where you really actually went to do harm to yourself, you wait 20 minutes, your life can be saved. So during that 20 minutes, pick up that damn phone, call 988. You know, the lady, the last time I did it, it was probably about 4 months ago. You know, keep in mind, I moved from California to Florida. That was a huge traumatic move for me. A big, big move. And the lady goes, do you need like a welfare check? Do you need us to come out? And I go, no, I'm okay. I just need to vent.
Right. Someone to listen.
I just need to vent. Like that's it. And then it dissipates. And there's, everything is anonymous. Like they don't know who I am. They don't know. I mean, they know my name, but they don't know who I am. They don't know my history unless I share it with them. I just needed a safe place to pick up the phone and call somebody. But my sisters were really shocked. They were like, yeah, but normally you would call like 211. And I'm like, yeah, but 211 was kind of like, hi. No, I was in a dark place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care. I have no shame in sharing my experience when it comes to my suicide attempt and calling 988. It saved my life. And you know what? I firmly believe God doesn't want me yet. That's how I'm looking at it. I'm here to share a story, an experience that if you hold on, this is where the acronym HOPE, hope, hold on, pain ends.
Oh, I like that. That's awesome.
Me
hold
too.
Hold on, pain ends. It's just people need to know who they can turn to.
What I really loved about your book, and right now, you're so real and raw, and the fact that it was so candid makes you so much more real. Like, you're not just this person in the headlines. You know, you're a real human with real feelings. And I mean, was that stressful and anxiety inducing to like release those thoughts and feelings on your darkest days to like the world in your book? That's amazing. Like,
I think it was actually cathartic.
Really?
Because I was finally able to be me.
Yeah.
Because for so many years, I was not allowed to be me. We were told what to do, what not to do, when to show up, when not to show up. I mean, for so many years, it was like everything. It was like, I mean, it's been in the headlines for so long, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, now that he's gone, like I've blocked TMZ, I've blocked Charlie, I've blocked Harvey. I've blocked everybody. Like, no, he's done. Don't call me for anything anymore. You're like, he's done. Nice knowing you for 30 years. Bye-bye.
Like, good for you.
I've moved on. And, but yeah, it was very, very healing for me to go through. You know, my book walks us through, you know, it walks the reader through like all the losses I had in high school. My best friend, Marissa, and my best friend, Troy, who really like affected my mental health. Like that really affected not only my mental health, but my spiritual health too. Because I doubted God. I hated God. I hated him. I was like, he finally got his act together and now you took him? Like,
right.
Like I got really, really mad at God, but prayed with the family, got my faith mojo back. We're all good. You know, but it's just everything takes time and it evolves when it's supposed to.
Good for you. That's a great attitude to have. It really is.
Right now, I'm in a good place, but when I'm not, that's when I pick up the phone. You know, we see it right now, right? David Hasselhoff's wife just took her own life today. Or
she did.
Right?
It was, yeah. Right.
Yesterday. And it's like, you know, you don't know what somebody's going through. And when you are in, when somebody like myself gets into that frame of mind, you're in a little bubble. And nothing around you even matters. Your kids don't matter. Your family doesn't matter. Your like nothing matters because it's just you isolated in this bubble, and you just want the pain to end.
And I feel like the people who don't go through it just look at you like, "What's wrong with him? He's always being a jerk, or he's doing this." But it's like they don't understand what is going on in your head.
And that's why it's kind of like, be patient with people because you don't know what somebody is going through.
Tanya, one of the things that I think is awesome about you is that you preach forgiveness. It's an admirable quality, but also I've dealt with hundreds of families over my career, families of victims, and they all grieve differently. And the ones that choose forgiveness astound me the most because they did something so horrible to your family and created this stress and this anxiety and all the depression. And yet you get past it by forgiving and moving on.
I think my mom really was the leader in that. My mom was like a kind of as cliche as it is because my mom and dad's focus was always about Sydney and Justin. It wasn't about the murder. It was always Sydney and Justin and what we needed to do to move on for the welfare of Sydney and Justin. And I just remember sitting in church that one day going, God, I want what my mom has. Like, I want that peace that, because I didn't hate him. I hated what he did, but I never hated him. And to this day, well, I we're talking 30 years. So there are some people I do hate. I think my mom was my guiding light in that. Where it's kind of like, I just remember sitting in church and sitting in the, you know, in the pew and saying to myself, I want what my mom has. I want this peace that she has. This, how is she able, like, and I would pray, like, God, like, how is this woman who lost her daughter and also her son, right? Because of
right.
considering mm-hmm. her son.
Right.
Where it's like, how, right? That's another thing that people don't understand. This was not a stranger. This was a family. This was a family member. So I really just want people to kind of grasp that. But my mom handled everything so beautifully and eloquently and just so stoically that she just goes, you know, I just wanted that piece that she had. And I remember I was in graduate school and she was going through cancer and she carried this way all throughout her entire life, not just during this chapter. You know, I'm in graduate school, I'm on my bed, I'm typing out my exam and all of that. And my mom has like no hair, no eyebrows, everything. She had stage 3C breast cancer. And here she is. She's like, in the garden. So my bedroom over like kind of looked out into a little garden area. And here she is. She's like looking at the petals of a flower. And I got mad.
Like, how are you doing? How are you so healthy in your head?
Right. I put my computer down and I go, how can you be so happy all the time? She goes, sure, I'm sick. And I have a dying husband. She goes, but I have all of you. I have a roof over my head. I have food on the table. My mom, World War II child, again, right, from Germany, who survived with five people with one egg a year, split between five people, right? And she just had this innate peace about her. And I just wanted that so badly. And but she carried that until the day she died.
She figured it out.
She figured it out. You know, I just remember she goes, "You Americans."
The Germans, so my experience with Germans is they don't mince words, and I appreciate that because they tell
they
you
what don't. They do. She goes, "You Americans would never survive a war." She goes, "Never." It's like you lose your phone, you panic, your computer goes down, you panic. She goes, "You guys would never survive a war." And
it's true. You know,
it's true. It's really true.
So true.
I can't wait to lose my phone. I'm like, "God, take it. Just take it."
Yeah.
But that's who my idol is, my mom. My dad was phenomenal too. But my dad was so sick, and we prayed for my dad to go. He was so sick with Alzheimer's, you know, but with my mom, both of them, my dad was kind of like the E.F. Hutton. Like, he walked into the room, everybody listened. He didn't even need to like say, like, he commanded respect without even saying anything. Like, he was just such an admirable, like, everybody respected Lou Brown, everybody. And my mom, she was just such a beautiful human being. And she's my idol.
Well, Tanya, I am so thankful that we got the chance to talk to you about your family and Nicole and just these stories that nobody gets to hear, because it sounds like your family had such a huge impact on you. And seriously, we cannot thank you enough for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for honoring my sister and my family. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we will talk very soon. Okay.
Fabulous.
All right. Thank you, Tanya.
You're welcome. Okay. Good night.
Can I just say, Melissa, that I was definitely not intimidated. I don't get intimidated by interviews, but I was nervous. I wanted to like really do a good job with this. And she was so down to earth and personable. It was easy. It was just like talking to somebody I've known 10 years.
She was so cool. And I did read her book. And I think that reading that helped me like see her as a regular person, because for how many years, like, there's been headlines. It's hard to wrap your mind around that sometimes. So, and just getting to sit here and talk to her, she was so down to earth, so cool.
It's true. And I feel like the stories we heard about Nicole, I don't know, that's kind of what we're doing here, if that makes any sense. Like, I don't care about the salacious story, the headlines. Like, we're about the victims, you know? And it was so great to just hear about Nicole, like the real Nicole.
Yeah.
So that was awesome. It was just great.
And you know what? She kept talking about how gorgeous Nicole is, and she definitely was, but Tanya was gorgeous too.
Yeah. Tanya's equally gorgeous. Like, she didn't give herself enough credit. Yeah.
She's beautiful. But
anyway.
Well, listeners, we would love to know what you think about our interview, and also what you think about March Madness, our theme this month, not the actual basketball. If you want to talk about that with Ed, fine, but not me.
You know where to find me.
Well, do they? If not, I will tell them. They can find you to talk about basketball or literally anything else with me at www.murderunscriptedpod.com, or you can shoot us an email at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can go on one of like any of the socials at murderunscripted.
It's true. And next week we have a story coming to you from the desk of Candace C.J. Johnson, who is our other research producer, who's been working behind the scenes on an incredible story that is going to feature a bonus episode, because there's just so much that went into it and some perspectives that we really like you guys to hear. So cannot wait to bring you that next week.
Yes, we are excited. So in the meantime, if you could like, rate, subscribe, review. I don't know if I missed any. Just do all the things.
Do the things, please.
All of them.
At once.
So until then, just remember, be nice. Remember what Tanya said, you never know what people are going through. So be nice. If you need help, reach out. Reach out to 988. Reach out to anybody. And most importantly, remember that perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
They do not. Yeah.
Bye. guys, it's Melissa from the Murder Unscripted podcast. In today's episode, we talked a lot about mental health and suicidal ideation. If you're struggling, please hear this. You are not alone. It can feel like the weight of the world is on your shoulders, but there is hope, there is help, and there are so many people who care about you. If you're thinking about suicide, please reach out. Your life is precious, and there is help right now in this moment. Don't be afraid to ask for it. Call or text the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline or talk to someone you trust. You don't have to carry this burden alone. Again, that number for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. You matter. You are loved. Please take that first step. You are so worth it.